listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Greetings, folks. It's Fran Barber here.
And Kylie Crabb. Today we're going to be discussing readings for Advent 4, and in particular we're actually going to focus on Luke 1, 39 to 55, which is the Gospel reading and the Psalm reading for the day. And today we are truly delighted to be joined by Dr. Anne Elvey. Anne is a biblical scholar and poet. She has a particular interest in Luke's Gospel. She's the author of many books, including An Ecological and Feminist Reading of Luke's Gospel, The Matter of the Text, and most recently, which is super relevant for today's discussion, Reading the Magnificat in Australia from 2020. So, Anne, thanks so much for joining us. It's great to have you here.
Oh, thanks, Kylie.
Yeah, thank you, Anne. I'm going to kick off with a pretty broad question. I'm really curious what drew you to focus on this particular text from Luke in your book.
Yeah. Okay. So as Kylie said, I've been working for some years with Luke's Gospel, and probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, perhaps a bit longer, I thought, since I'm also a poet, I'd start looking at the texts that in Luke that were most like poetry.
So yeah, nice.
That drew me to the Magnificat. I've got one article on the Benedictus.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And what is it about the nature of your reading of this text that's distinct? Your approach that's particular, would you say?
I suppose I started thinking about, earlier I, and still, I'm interested in ecological readings.
Yeah. Mm.
And I, so in some ways I, some of my readings are around that. So, but more recently I was interested in how do you read a text in an Australian context of invasion, which is ongoing. And so that's, I guess, the particularity of it. And probably, I don't know if I should say this in this setting, but that sort of work really should be done collaboratively.
Mm-hmm,
so yeah. There is a flaw at the basis of what I'm doing. But I did it from a settler perspective.
Yeah, right.
So it should really be done collaboratively with First Nations peoples, but that would be another project. So, and which I don't know it's not my project now, but this is a settler reading, and it partly examines whiteness too, but we probably won't go into that today.
And I'm sure we'll come back to this, but it strikes me that the Magnificat is a fantastic, in addition to being poetry, so it's like meeting that that criterion and interest for you. It's a fantastic text to consider colonial contexts in. So I'm sure that we'll come back to that.
Yes, it's power dynamics through and through.
That's right. Comes from its own colonial setting.
So perhaps we should start with the text itself, ladies of Luke and scholarship. Are there particular words or translations? I've noted one or two, just with the word blessed being a different different word used in that visitation section. That may or may not be significant in your views, but what would you draw out?
We should probably say exactly that this is reminding us that we've got the Magnificat here, and the Magnificat is the other verses that are set up for the psalm, and also I think in brackets for the gospel reading of the day. But all of this is sort of set in our story today at what we call the visitation, this encounter between Elizabeth and Mary when Mary is said to go to Zechariah's house, but she speaks with Elizabeth. Did you want to say something about blessing, Anne?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's really interesting that it's two women meeting, and the scene is around these two women, and that often earlier male scholars saw it still about the two babies in the womb, supposedly.
Yes.
I mean, we're not even, yeah. So So it sort of was really interesting how they got the women got elided in early scholarship on this.
Yep. Way of rating films, where if you have two women who have names and talk about something other than a man. I'm not sure if we've got exactly talking about something other than a man here, but we're talking about the Lord. but we have this amazing, really, encounter between these two named female characters.
Yeah. And so I didn't actually bring the Greek of the thing, so now I'm trying to remember where the blessed was. So one is blessed eulo, so the like a eulogy, that kind of blessed. And the other one's Makarios, so like in the Beatitudes.
Yeah.
And one of the things one of the blesseds does is send us back to Jael, who's so one of these, you know, fairly fierce old Hebrew Bible women, because that blessing sort of echoes in her. So I think, I'm not sure. Sometimes people don't make that much distinction between the two forms of blessing.
Mm-hmm. One thing I read was that clearly the one that's used in the Beatitudes can be translated as happy.
Yeah, it can. Yes.
Yeah. I'm curious why Mary visited Elizabeth. That is, you know, was it to, was it a kind of ministry to Elizabeth to support her, you know, that yes, this really is happening, it's happening to me too, albeit slightly different order of things? Or, I don't know, maybe you've not thought about that.
Just, you're thinking about it like a kind of like mentoring kind of relationship between this older woman and the younger woman. Yeah. There's certainly something, isn't there, about that both of the women are kind of remarkable in their pregnancies because of their age and situation, but in different ways.
Or, you know, or is it that Mary, you know, she's the paragon of faith, the one who says yes, that's how we traditionally understand her. But she's coming here. Is she actually unsure coming here going, do you think this is for real, Elizabeth?
I don't know. I mean, I just think Luke as an author sets it up, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes,
and,
that's right.
And he has. I mean, Mary shows remarkable initiative in going on this long journey, and then you just have this. I mean, even though there's kind of some focus on the children that are to be, the blessing of each other and the prophecy and the rising up of the spirit is in the interaction between the two women. So true, it's quite a remarkable text.
Yes, it's this companionship.
And I think that can maybe be a bit lost on some of us, you know, how really remarkable and radical it is.
There is something in Luke about things that happen and then are reported to happen, or something, you know, like something, someone has an experience and then they go tell someone else about it. And this happens throughout Acts as well. So there's a sense in which, I think Brendan Byrne would point this out, there's a sense in which this kind of happens and then there's this interaction between them. The other sort of thing we might, but this is again, bring it back to the children, but there is also throughout the two chapters of infancy narratives, there is this thing that we sometimes call step parallelism. There's this parallel between John and Jesus and the situations around them, which are not designed to kind of put John down, I don't think, in any way. They celebrate John and then they say kind of how much more with this other child. Mm. And so we get this sense here that this remarkable thing is happening with Elizabeth, and she's in the she's in the tradition of all of these Hebrew Bible women as well, who finally have this conceived this amazing long longed for child. But even in this moment, there's this recognition of the child that's that Mary carries that is somewhat different.
I mean, there is. But it's more than that.
Yes.
Because you end up with the women really, in a sense, taking the stage and being a focus.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, like it's not – it's remarkable, but it's not a departure from the Hebrew Bible tradition in that sense of you've got Miriam. It's not just the special births in the, you've got Miriam and Deborah and Jael as well as Hannah, who, and you know, so it harks back to
all these other songs.
All these other women and other songs that and tradition of, you know, strong women who so I think it's an interesting, but it's also almost a setting the stage or for the aria. Someone calls those bits in Luke's gospel the songs as like arias in an opera. I've forgotten, it might have been Tanner Hill, but someone. So I think, that's.
And the first line of that, Mary said, "My soul magnifies the Lord."
Mm.
What is that? I mean, I can think literally as a magnifying glass, that is, my soul reflects God. You know, I mean, we are in the image of God as human.
Mm.
Yeah.
You know, all of that's packed into that little line, I think.
Yeah. Mm. I think that's right. I think it's a funny word, isn't it? Mm. Something about, I mean, it's a funny word in English is what I'm also trying to say.
Yeah.
But something, you know, that idea, that enlarging, I mean, and we get it in the hymn as well about the tell out my soul, the greatness of the Lord.
There's
this kind
mention,
of sense of expansion.
That's
sort of
the hymn for the week.
Because,
beautiful.
Because I think it means makes great. So it would be that tell out. Yeah.
Yes.
But the soul thing isn't like what we might have thought about, you know, something divorced from the body or, to separated at death. It's the whole person.
Mm. It's the life force.
Yeah, like the psyche. The word is psyche. So so it's the whole person.
So the all of me.
Yeah. My whole self.
Yeah.
That's worth really underlying, I think, by preachers, because we do hear that bifurcation of body and soul being inheritors of Greek categories.
and then there's sort of the parallelism in the next line with my spirit, but the word pneuma is breath. So it's like my whole being, my breath. Breath, spirit. And I like, there's a Hebrew Bible scholar, Theodore Hebert, who talks about ruach, which is the Hebrew equivalent of pneuma. And the breath is connected with, so it's breath, spirit, air. And if you're thinking, say, in a world of climate change, it's also atmosphere. Mm. So that whole, and wind.
Life force.
So all of,
it's life force, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's also very material.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. It's real stuff.
And so it's sort of a word that we can see as connecting us to the wider world as well.
Which those two lines can be read the other way completely from that.
Yeah.
That's totally immaterial or kind of like esoteric. Mm. Yeah. Very good. Any other words that we're wanting to kind of highlight or think about? I noticed the thing in verse 51 about the in the thoughts of their hearts. This is how the proud are brought down. And I think maybe even last week in the podcast we were talking about the inner thoughts of many being revealed and the way that John the Baptist also ends up revealing the inner thinking in his ministry. So this is an important thing in Luke, this kind of revelation, stripping back what's going on inside for people.
And also, and look, this is easy for people to find in study Bibles too, but just to note that the references to the Psalms in almost each line, so holy is his name is a reference that can be found in Psalm 111, and just sort of the echoes of other texts that are being brought in here, and sort of the reinterpretation and the repurposing of the tradition within this aria.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, in terms of other words, so there's a couple of other words that I think are worth thinking about is doule, which comes at the end of the Annunciation episode, and then again here.
Remind us what doule is.
So I'm getting there. often it gets neatly translated as servant.
Yes,
but it's a word for slave woman.
Yeah,
so it's the feminine of, so it's slave woman. And so, and also when you take that with kurios, there's lord and so master and slave is there echoed there. Now, another thing that you were saying about the Magnificat, the word magnifying. So there's this sense that this is often taken as a song of praise, and I think it is, but it's also another type of thing, which is probably best described as a song of protest or resistance. So, but I don't think they offer. Sometimes I've got challenged before some years ago about whether it's one or the other, but I think it's both.
Yeah.
So it's praise and resistance at the same time. And so the doulé part, I think we do have to hear it as slave, but there are issues around that in that Mary probably was not literally a slave herself.
Yeah.
She was probably a peasant, even in Luke's terms, in terms of Luke's gospel. So, so use of it's interesting.
Hannah refers to herself as the servant as well, I think.
Yeah, so there are a number of traditions. Like there's the servant of God tradition, but there's also this question of what's happening in the Roman Empire with mastery and slavery, I think, and why you would use that term. So if I like to look at the different possibilities.
Well, and also to think about. Yeah. I mean, one of the tricks we have, right, is that our English translations will often translate this as servant because it's more comfortable to us.
So
it doesn't tell us what we have to do with the word once we realise it means slave. But we do need to recognise that the word is slave.
Yes.
And then and then take it from there, I think.
But isn't it also countercultural and a word of resistance if you're claiming to be a slave of God and not of the emperor? So in that sense it's challenging absolutely. The authority and the order of the world.
Maybe. The other word I want to come back to eventually is humiliation or shame, but we'll do that in a minute. But, I think that, yes, but what happens if we use a term that's about a relationship of power, of master over slave, and then apply it to God and humans. Yeah. It's not necessarily how you want to image either of us.
Yeah.
So that's also a question for later in the Magnificat of the reversals, like, you know, this and we'll come back to that, I imagine.
We can also talk about it. Now, I think that there is something, right, about this. How are we going to deal with this, that there's this language of because it's not just the slave language. It's about it's about Lord and who the Lord is. Caesar isn't Lord, but this is the Lord. And this is the kind of way that this Lord is characterized by raising up the humble and scattering the proud and this kind of thing. But then we do have we do have this kind of tension to really wrestle with, I think, about whether these texts, when we're not thinking about how it worked in their original setting, but when we take them out of that setting and talk about those power relationships in our setting, are we reinscribing imperial categories by simply reversing them or saying God is like, the text doesn't say God is like Caesar. God says that God, the text says that God is actually quite different. This Kyrios, this Lord, is actually quite different from that. Mm. So it's not just doing that. But if we're just switching the table so the people who are at the bottom are now at the top and start to lord it over everybody else, are we just doing the same thing with a different group of people? And how do we pay attention to that? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a preaching point as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it puts me in mind, just briefly, folks, of the Micah reading that's set for this week, which talks about Bethlehem. But you, O Bethlehem of Ephrathah, who are one of the little clans of Judah, so this insignificant, small place, and this ordinary, insignificant place where God turns up. And we see God turning up in ordinary and insignificant places all the time. But it's not just that God takes on the body of the lowly, but that God then does away with our making of hierarchies. Mm-hmm. So that, there's a reversal, but there's also I think, a challenge of the whole notion of putting things in that in an order of power.
Mm. I guess that's the question, right? Mm. And the thing to wrestle with. Does this lead us into what you wanted to say about humiliation, Anne?
Maybe. I'm still thinking about the power and the reversals, because I think there is – it's still an issue. Mm. And I don't know that shifting it to God really helps that much. And I don't think we have to accept the text as it is.
Yep.
Like part of the interpretive process is – connecting with our current context and have a bit of back and forth about it. So the humiliation is one of the things about connecting with the current context that would bring up questions for me is about colonialism and power in that response sense. And when Mary talks about her loneliness, it can be translated humiliation, and probably is better translated as humiliation. And that also has echoes of shame, I guess. Mm. And the humiliation could be her situation, and it could also be when she stands in Luke's mind for Israel and their situation, like the people's situation. So I think it's possibly both. I mean, there are ideas that it's often related to sexual violence. So, but also it could be the humiliation of being conquered and occupied. So I think the humiliation part's really important for hearing then the next part, because the violence of the divine actions in the next part is being written from an underside. So but it's written in a way as though it's already happened.
Yeah, it's all past tense verbs, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's written in a way as though it's already happened, which is part of the praise thing, I guess. Mm. You know, and I don't think it necessarily means it has already happened, but that has been another way of reading it.
Yeah.
But I think it's a way of the idea of a song of protest is that it affirms the people's dignity. It has a number of aspects, not all of which I can remember at the moment, but this would be part of the protest genre.
Mm.
You know, like we've sung We Shall Overcome and all those sorts of things at rallies. So it's that kind of genre.
Mm.
And this song was actually, and I've forgotten which country, but it was banned in part of South America or Latin America, South or Central America, because it was
so radical.
Because it was being used in protests against government. Mm. So,
in the Australian context, where has it been? Has it been used as a protest song specifically, or you're saying it needs to be? Or
I'm not saying. I don't know.
Yeah,
yeah, right. I don't know. One of the things the Australian context would ask me to think about is land, and an ecological context always also asks me to think about that. And land doesn't seem to be in it if you look at it, except that it mentions the promise and the covenant.
Yeah, and Abraham. So land is, land's Abraham, implied,
so land
yeah.
is there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the generations in it seem to be male, but we don't have to stick with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so, right.
Yeah. So the ancestry is there, those ideas of land and ancestry, are important, but we don't have to take things exactly as they are in the text.
So if I could get you to summarise, when you're, you know, we've got preachers listening out there, not from Australia actually.
Mm.
We've got just a few minutes left. What are sort of maybe, I don't know, two or three or however many you want, key new points for people or cautions or that you would ask them to take about this text this year?
Mm.
And you as well, Kylie, maybe.
I think
maybe.
Kylie can go first.
No, well, I mean, I want to hear what Anne wants to say. But, I mean, I think that this, just thinking about that, how we think about the kind of military language of this text and make sense of that and notice whether we are truly talking about a new structure to human society when we think about how we image God in this time, as it, you know, it's Advent, as we imagine and long for God to break into our systems and remake them. Are we reinscribing new imperial categories, or are we finding a whole new way of being together in God's world and looking for God in our midst? I think that is a theme that comes out strongly for me, and noticing the stuff which will not probably be new to people, but you know that Luke does care about people who are actually hungry. You know, the opposite of the actual hungry here are the rich, and we might wonder about where each of us fits within that dichotomy or spectrum. But you know that this is not about you know, the poor in spirit or whatnot, that is still an important group of people to wonder about in Matthew's gospel. But Luke is interested in you know, the poor and how we think about those categories.
Yeah, that's really important. Yeah. I made one of the things I do is kind of do some creative responses to it. And one I did was in response actually to an abstract artwork called Magnificat. And I did some blanking out of bits. So one version is looking at the power stuff, and it's called Empty Power. And the other version is looking at the other aspect of this text, and you come down to where it says remember mercy. So, you know, because the divine remembers mercy for the people. So I think that picks up a bit on what you were saying. That, I mean, there's both aspects, but we probably want to go with the remember mercy part.
Yes, yeah.
And the other thing I kind of come to, which is more a homiletic point, is that in an Australian context where this text comes as a colonial artefact, you know, it comes, and not just as part of the Bible, but it comes as, you know, right, well, in the 19th century it comes as sung in churches and concert halls, and it gets prayed, you know, in some places daily as part of Evensong. So this is a text that gets imported as a colonial artefact. And I think what it does, or could do if we hear it as a song as well of protest as well as praise, is point us towards who's speaking resistance to us as colonizers presently, or who's speaking up about climate change in their Pacific Island nations, which is often women. And, you know, there was Kathy, who's I can't remember. I should know the surname better, but from the Marshall Islands, who spoke at the UN. So you could probably find her on the internet. We might put it in the notes. So there are people speaking up using poetry or poetic or song sort of genres. That I think this text kind of pushes us to listen to.
And I would connect that with a rather broad sort of a remark, just that we're at Advent 4 and it's a crazy time of year for most of us, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere, where our academic years end and our school years end and all of the Christmas madness. And there is a temptation to sort of move to Christmas preemptorily on Advent 4 because everyone might be away or cooking a roast on Christmas Day and so on. And this reading actually invites us again to maintain that posture of waiting and expectation. What does the waiting look like in the protest songs that we find in our own culture and world? And I did share this podcast in the By the World group this week, but there's a wonderful conversation between Andrew Root and John Swinton. John Swinton wrote a book called Becoming Friends of Time, Discipleship, Timefulness and Gentle Discipleship. but just about our whole relationship with time as particularly so-called Westerners. And it's a fascinating sort of history of how we got to the minutes and the hours and the sense of commodification. And that this, that as liturgical beings, that's our liturgical time, and that this text grounds us again to remember that and to stay with this text and what it is saying in the world before we come to the blessed happy day of Jesus' birth on the 25th of December.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much for joining us, Anne, and really enriching our understanding of this text.
Yeah, thanks so much, Anne. It's been terrific.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, folks.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.